Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you guys today?
Maintaining.
Well, we're still in a global pandemic, so that's how I'm doing.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Maybe all pandemics are global.
Yeah, pandemic anyway. Is by definition global. Thank you for repeating yourself. Before we get started with the show, I wanted to fill our loyal listeners in on a special promotion we are running as our nation continues into lockdown mode. For a limited time, you can get 2 months free access to everything at RebellerMedia.com. Everything for free. That's not a nothing Zippo. Free. You will find the offer at the top left corner of RebellerMedia.com. It's right there. Just go to the homepage. You can click it, check it out. Sign up. It'll be good. The bad news is that you're locked away at home right now. But the good news is if you click on that originals tab up at the top of the website, you will have a treasure trove of content to sift through. We celebrated the life and times of the great screenwriter and director John Milius last week, who wrote and directed Red Dawn and Conan the Barbarian, as well as writing Apocalypse Now. And he did uncredited punch-ups on Jaws, Dirty Harry, and countless other pictures you know and love. We are paying good people good money for the content you're enjoying, including the content you're enjoying right now. And we hope you'll sign up for a membership, which will give you unlimited access. After the free period ends, it's just $2 a month. $2! That's less than most Patreons, and you get so much more bang for your buck. And now, on to the show. First up, we have a real-life controversies and controversies. It's like old times again. Louis C.K. is back with a new special, one that he taped during his recent run of sold-out stand-up shows, and that he premiered on his own platform, louisck.com. The special is the first since taking a step back into the limelight following a New York Times piece revealing that he liked to, pleasure himself in front of women with only a cursory request for permission. The set itself is funny, not quite as brilliant as some of his other stuff, and not quite as finely tuned as some of his other material. You get the sense that he couldn't quite work things out on the road as he was used to. But, you know, that's not that surprising. No one ever denied that Louis C.K. can still make an audience laugh. The thing everyone wants to hear is how he deals with the unpleasantness that got him in so much trouble. And that's kind of what's fascinating about this special to me. He doesn't actually seem that apologetic. One gets the sense that he still thinks he basically played by the rules, and that the rules changed mid-game, and that this rule change was deeply unfair to him personally. This hesitation to apologize may not be admirable, depending on your POV, but it does show something pretty interesting, which is the power of owning your own distribution channels. If you don't have to rely on advertisers, and if you don't have to rely on a third-party subscription service that can be pressured by outrage mobs and letter-writing campaigns and who else, you don't really need to apologize when you don't feel like you have to. Alyssa, is Louis C.K.'s effort to own and market and distribute his own work and, most importantly to him, not ever have to apologize to anyone, a harbinger of things to come in our current Hollywood meltdown as smaller scale art may come to the fore as people can't rely on theaters and all that sort of stuff? Or is he simply personally, just Louis C.K., too big to fail?
I mean, look, I think most people in the entertainment industry are not big enough to be able to sell their own work for $8.99 a pop through their own distribution channels, in part because most people don't know who they are, right? I mean, it's hard to get people to pay for stuff, period. We know that. We're all in the journalism business and all more or less in subscription areas of the journalism business. But people have to know that you exist and are putting out new material if they're going to pay for your stuff. I should note, I was sort of thinking about this before the podcast, and I, despite, you know, thinking that it's bad to take out your genitals and start playing with them in front of people who may not be into that sort of thing, I don't really have a problem with him releasing a new special. I think that he has a right to work, and frankly, that I am more comfortable with him distributing this on his own in a way where people who want it can go out and affirmatively decide to purchase it than I am with what he was doing before, which was these sort of surprise appearances, which to me, in a weird way, kind of paralleled what he is accused of doing, right? I mean, obviously, it's not the same to take a comedy stage when you haven't been announced as part of the bill as it is to, again, like just take your genitals out in front of someone else with no particular warning. But there was just sort of something about that that felt unself-aware as a means of returning. And look, it's tricky. I mean, it's not like if he had announced in advance that he was doing some of these early shows, you know, the venue owners might have backed down, there might have been protests. I can see why he didn't do that. But the whole thing made me fairly queasy. And so a situation where he's like, hey, this is available. If you want it, you can buy it, seems to me to be like a pretty morally decent solution for everybody, except for the people who think that he should go away absolutely forever. And I don't necessarily count myself as one of those.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the Surprise Comedy Club appearances, Alyssa, because that is like actually how most stand-ups fine-tune their sets. And this is one of the things that I think is interesting about his show. I don't think he actually was able to do that fine-tuning here, which has real problems with the strength of the set. It's not the best possible works. I mean, it's easy to say, okay, well, he shouldn't do stand-up sets except for these big specials. But if he doesn't do those, he really can't do a special, you know?
It's tricky. I mean, I think I both agree with you sort of purely logistically, but I do think the parallels between the sort of surprise set and the surprise my genitals, it's just queasy. It's difficult. And you know, look, I mean, I think in terms of behavior that men were accused of during Me Too, there's obviously a range. And I do think that there's a moral difference between Louis C.K. and Harvey Weinstein. There's a difference between masturbating in front of someone and forcibly raping someone. And I do think that C.K. has been sort of more publicly reflective and, you know, thoughtful about some of this stuff than some of the other people who have been accused as part of this. But yeah, like the material about what he's accused of is just not that great, right? I mean, saying like, yes, for sure, like that you should be really, really sure that someone actually wants you to do something sexually before you do it. Like that's sort of like consent 101 education. And I think that a lot of these powerful men who were accused to a certain extent just didn't understand the way that consent can be sort of manufactured or how it can operate on multiple levels, right? That like someone might say yes, but not because they affirmatively really want to have sex with you, but because they think it's essential for their job or because they don't feel like they have the ability to say no. And so the idea that consent can be manufactured is like pretty basic. The actual joke in that part of the episode is that it's like, think about what it's like to have like Barack Obama know what your weird thing is and be disappointed in you. And okay, that's like kind of funny, but it's not a great joke. I mean, it's, you know, part of what I always find really compelling about Louis C.K. is that, you know, his stuff gets really bluntly at some of the ickiness that can happen between men and women. And this actually feels just a lot more surface than that. It's less interesting and less revealing as a joke. And so, yeah, I mean, the material's not that great. I don't know a way that he could have perfected it that also would have felt sort of more ethically reasonable. It's a conundrum. But I don't really have a problem with him releasing the special, but I don't necessarily think it's going to be a model for other people to follow.
Yeah. Peter, you said before the show that you have never watched a minute of Louis C.K., which I find fascinating because you're a lover of art and comedy and that sort of stuff. Why have you been boycotting Louis C.K. since before it was? Why are you the hipster boycotter of Louis C.K.? You were doing it before it was cool.
Yeah, so I have not only did I not watch 1 minute of this special, I have never watched a single minute of any Louis C.K. stand-up. it is probable that I have seen some clips from his old, it was on show on FX, I think.
Yeah, the FX show.
But was Lucky Louie, too.
Yeah, so you described me as a lover of comedy, and in fact, I'm kind of not. I don't watch comedy specials at all.
Yeah,
I don't really watch television comedy at all, with a very few exceptions. There's some scripted shows, mostly animated, that I do watch and that I think are probably worth my time. But this is a little bit apart from the core conversation here, but my solution to peak TV has been James Cameron's solution to editing too long movies. And James Cameron always said that, you know, he kind of famously really cut down Aliens and The Abyss. And so there are these director's cuts that exist that are much longer. And what he said was his approach to editing when he turned in a movie that was deemed too long was he didn't try to just trim little bits out here and there. He would take out an entire subplot, just one whole subplot, no longer there. That's the easy way to make your movie much shorter. And so we know he did that in The Abyss, and we know he did that in The Aliens. And so what I have done in the era of peak TV is to take out an entire genre of stuff that I just don't watch, and I never have to think about it. Oh, there's a new comedy that's getting great reviews. It's really smart about life and the way the world works, and like it tells you so much about Washington or Silicon Valley. I don't have to watch them. I don't, because I just know that I don't watch those things.
That's the saddest thing I've ever heard. That's legitimately one of the saddest things I've ever heard, Peter. I'm very disappointed
in you.
You're leaving a whole like segment of the human experience unexamined and whatever.
I play video games, but I don't play pinball. And there's lots of great pinball machines.
Nobody plays pinball anymore. You can't have pinball machines in your house. Come on, we're not all.
You've got a big enough house.
We're not all, you know, oligarchs.
I don't bowl. There's just lots of stuff I don't do. And one of the things that I don't do is watch comedy specials ever or virtually any live action TV comedy.
Oh, God. I guess I shouldn't complain too much since this is basically how I feel about music. I stopped listening to music about 15 years ago.
Yeah, and
I don't need music anymore. That's a thing I've cut out of my life.
So as somebody who is not a student of Louis C.K., I think the thing that I have encountered that to me best expresses the kind of the question here that at least that we need to ask is what Jesse Single wrote in his newsletter. And Single is at least says he is like a long time, pretty old school, pretty deep fan of Louis C.K. And the title of his piece on this is what should we do about the fact that Louis C.K. is still very good at what he does? And this is, I think, the right question to ask. Single, to his credit, doesn't have like a really clear answer. What he says is nobody else does either, because it's very difficult to describe a clear mechanism by which Louis C.K. should simply go away and disappear from life. And Single doesn't excuse him for what he did. Like, he tries to describe in granular detail, you know, without sort of over, you know, so that he could actually sort of say, here's what he did, here's why it was wrong. He doesn't say, you know, that was fine, like we shouldn't worry about it. He says he did something. It was wrong. And also, this guy is still an incredible entertainer. What are we going to do about that? I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure anyone does.
I do.
It does, like, as with, like Alyssa said, no, but it does seem to me like the, oh, I want to hear, I want to hear.
I actually know the answer. Okay. We just let him work. That's because bad people do things sometimes. And, you know, sometimes they're still good at things that are unrelated to the bad thing. So they get to work.
So that's true. And the problem with, and like, again, I'm not saying that I have the answer. So when I raise this caveat, this is not to suggest there is a clear answer. There isn't one to me. The problem with what Louis C.K. did was that it was bound up with his work. And so it wasn't just something that he did in a purely personal capacity. He did it in at least a quasi-professional capacity. And so that complicates people who then decide to work with him and give him platforms from which to work. Now, again, I am not saying he should never be allowed to work again. I'm saying that it is not obvious exactly how we should think about either culturally, professionally, or, you know, sort of from our perspective as critics, someone who commits, who does something that we would frown upon in a professional capacity.
But I also think that a sort of self-produced and self-distributed comedy special, Sonny, is just a much easier case to adjudicate than, you know, if Harvey Weinstein had been acquitted and then was acquitted again in California, would we be like, oh yeah, sure, let's go back to him making movies? Because, you know, the potential for Louis C.K. to leverage his ability as a comedian when he is doing something where he's like producing his own work, he's distributing his own work, there are fewer people who have to come in contact with him, there are not people who are auditioning for parts in that, he does not have, you know, power in the industry through that to control. I mean, part of the thing about Harvey Weinstein is he basically had a monopoly on good roles for women in Hollywood for a long time. And he was a gatekeeper. He could be sort of transactional. And so it seems obvious that we should not allow Harvey Weinstein, and that no, you know, no financier, no insurer is going to let Harvey Weinstein back in that position. But something where, like, this new special that is just lower risk to the people around him, that's it's much easier to say, yeah, oh, of course you should continue working. There are no criminal charges, right? I mean, you know, it's just, it's an easier case. And I think that's worth taking into account.
Yeah. I mean, I also think Harvey Weinstein is accused of something much more serious, frankly. I mean, like this is not to say that, you know, Louis C.K. was right, as I've written. I think he probably was not right. I think he's wrong to not feel shame for what he has done. but at the same time, it's not forcible rape. So different. It's just different.
Yeah. Oh, no. You're saying he's right to feel shame for what he's done.
Yeah. I'm saying he's right to, he is wrong to not feel shame.
I think he does though. I mean,
I don't think he, no,
apology,
I absolutely don't. You guys need to actually like watch the 10 minutes where he talks about it on the special, because I do not get the sense at all that he is even a, I mean, maybe, I think he's sorry that it happened to him. I think he is sorry that this all occurred. I do not think that he is sorry necessarily for the thing that he did. But you know, that's me trying to be mind reader. Who knows? Maybe I'm wrong. All right. So like I said, we have an actual controversy or non-troversy here. Is it a controversy or a non-troversy that Peter doesn't watch comedy? What the hell?
Yeah, it's a controversy that both of you have forsworn large segments of things that can give you joy. Just, you two are just the worst.
I think we can all agree on that.
Yes. Accurate. Definitely a controversy. Okay. So on to the main event, Devs. We're talking about Devs today. You may not have heard of Devs. I think a lot of people haven't heard of Devs, but it's a show produced by FX that is streaming exclusively on Hulu. Do you got that? Its season finale is on Thursday, and the show has been great. I really love it, and I'm hoping that it continues to be great through the finale. We wanted to highlight it because it's not getting nearly enough attention. People probably don't even know it exists because it's on this whole FX on Hulu thing. Have we talked about how there are too many platforms recently? Devs is from Alex Garland, the brilliant writer-director of Ex Machina and Annihilation, who rose to prominence as the screenwriter of Danny Boyle's The Beach, 28 Days Later, and Sunshine. Like several
so
of those...
So he actually wrote the novel The Beach.
And he also wrote the novel The Beach, right. Don't interrupt me while I'm doing my introduction,
oh.
Peter.
Okay.
Just sit there and think about your non-comedy listening self. Like several of those offerings, Devs is a high-concept but not quite hard science story. In this case, it's about a quantum computer designed to show us the past and the future via quantum mechanics or something, wrapped up in a more human mystery. A female programmer at this company that owns the quantum machine magic computer is trying to discover how and why her Russian boyfriend died at the hands of his own company. That company is headed up by Nick Offerman, best known as the gruff keeper of parks on Parks and Rec. He's playing a tech guru here whose dead daughter has inspired his effort to stare into the past. Devs comes back to a pretty basic question handled in a slightly different way. Do we have free will, or are we fated to travel a certain path? But the slight difference here, I think, is key, and I'm curious to see if they get into this in the finale. Even if we have free will to choose a different path, because every path is possible if the multiverse is real and everything that can happen will happen. Is that really free will at all, or just a variation on fate, that we are fated to do everything in some way? Like I said, I've loved the show so far. I think it's the kind of thing that will appeal to all sorts of middle brows like me out there. Peter, is there a corner of the multiverse in which Devs is actually an enormous hit?
I think possibly. I think the corner in which the pandemic was a much smaller deal, in which we weren't all kind of freaking out over a global shutdown of everything. This is the kind of show that is designed to appeal to critics, and it is perhaps then not surprising that I absolutely love it. It is hard to remember any show that I've liked this much in years, even Watchmen, as much as I think Watchmen was a real achievement and was technically just phenomenal, especially in the back half of the season. This is the first show in a very long time that I am actually anxious to watch each week, that I really want to see what happens, that I care about both the story and the characters. And it's a fascinating kind of, as you said, a philosophical question. But as with all of his all of his stories, it's also it raises a moral question. It is about what happens when the rules of the world that you think exist suddenly, for some reason, no longer exist. And that's true in 28 Days Later. That's true in The Beach. It's true to some extent in Ex Machina, in Annihilation, which is literally about a zone in which there's physics no longer applies. And he's really interested in these sort of in suspensions of rules, which makes him, of course, very timely for this moment. And his question is, in some ways, not just do we have free will or not? But what if we don't? What would it mean to be a moral person in a world where free will doesn't exist at all? And it is actually, it's a very smart, very thorough, kind of interesting and deeply humane treatment of that question. That's also just like, guys, this show looks so good.
It sounds so good.
And each episode starts with these weird kind of trippy montages that run right before the credit sequence. And especially if you're sort of playing this through any kind of surround system or good speakers, it has just been so exquisitely produced. And so I love every single thing about this series. I wish it were a bigger hit. I think in some ways it has a bigger, to me, it affects me a little more because of the state of the world. But if the world were in a different state, this is the kind of show that I can imagine being picked up by a lot of critics a couple of episodes in and people talking about it a lot more. And I hope that at some point that still happens, because it really deserves everyone's time and attention.
Alyssa?
Yeah, I want to caveat this by saying I totally get why people find Alex Garland pretentious. Like, everything in everything he does is always just a lot. It's a lot of sound production. It's a lot of philosophizing. It's a lot of events. It's a lot of mystery. And yet there is something just really emotionally sincere and wonderful about everything that he does. I was talking to you guys on GChat yesterday and basically said that in a weird way, watching Devs reminds me of reading Kazuo Shiguro's Remains of the Day, which is this novel about a sort of repressed English butler who has, through his own sort of dedication to rectitude, given up his chance at happiness. And there's this just really powerful emotional restraint in Devs, but it's not because the characters don't feel anything. It's because they feel far too much, and they're trying to sort of protect themselves against the overwhelming power of their own emotions. And I think that's an interesting entrant in Garland's sort of moral oeuvre. Because as you mentioned, he's very interested in scenarios where the rules stop applying. Whether there's, a total global breakdown because of a zombie apocalypse in 28 Days Later, or, where someone's designed a robot that meets the Turing test, etc. But part of what's interesting and I think kind of distinctive about Devs is that there's this really strong yearning for the rules to apply, right? I mean, you know, Forrest, who's played by Nick Offerman, and it's a great performance, who's the founder of this company, Amaya, named after his daughter, who, as we learn, died in a car accident that he believes himself to be at least partially responsible for. He was talking to her mother on the phone when she was driving home. It was like a, it was a really unnecessary phone call. His wife was almost home. And he saw them get hit by the car that killed them. And, you know, he, part of the reason he is so attached to a deterministic version of the universe is because he believes it is one in which he is responsible, right? I mean, he wants to be found guilty. He doesn't want to believe that Amaya and his wife died for no reason. He wants to believe that, you know, there was a cause for it. He was the cause, therefore he is guilty. And, you know, he and Katie, who's played by Alison Pill, who I love in everything and I think is particularly good in this, you know, have this conversation early in the series after they've had Sergei killed, where, you know, Forrest talks about, you know, wanting to be sort of morally evolved in a way that lets him get over having killed Forrest. And yet that doesn't seem really sincere, right? I mean, there's this yearning for rules and order, even among this person who has pushed science and our understanding of time just totally beyond its limits. And that moral yearning for order is this really sort of melancholy and lovely thing at the heart of the series.
Alyssa, can I quibble with one thing that you say in that? Is do we think that the Nick Offerman character in this show? So again, to lay out what happens in case you haven't watched it and are still listening to this, Nick he sees his wife and child driving in a van toward him. He's on the phone with them. She says, "This is a stupid phone call. I hate being on the phone talking while I'm driving." And then literally like 3 seconds later gets T-boned by a speeding truck that just demolishes the van, knocks it all over the place. So he is trying to discover if we have a single fated existence or if there is a multiverse, right? That is basically what the conflict at the heart of this is, right?
Well, but I think that's not quite it, right? I mean, he says explicitly that, you know, the project is dedicated to a deterministic theory of the universe and punishes and fires someone who's part of the team who has what appears to be a major breakthrough in the product
I don't think the conflict is about him asking whether we are in a deterministic world or whether we are in a many worlds world with where choices apply and can change things. What he is trying to do with Devs is absolve his conscience of responsibility for something that happened that he believes he has. That he is worried that he may have some culpability in. Because
I totally disagree with that. No, I think he wants to be found guilty. I think
this is the question I wanted to get to. Because I think this is an interesting debate. Because if they live in a world, if we live in a world where the multiverse is real, then the choice that he made is clearly a bad one. He killed his family. But if we live on the tram lines, if there's only one fate and there every action inevitably leads to the next thing, then he is absolved. And so the question is,
he is trying to prove
Alyssa
the theory
right.
that absolves him.
Right. So
right? That's why
he... But I wonder if that is it. I think Alyssa is right to ask, does he want to be held responsible or does he want to absolve himself? And it's not entirely clear from the show. I don't think the show takes a very strong side one way or the other. I think it allows us to try and guess what he is feeling at.
It's possible that in the finale we could find out that what he has actually been doing is forcing everyone to adhere to a deterministic world so almost as a sort of a devil's argument, right? Like, you know, in hopes of basically ruling out the determinism. Like that, I think, will, you know, is a possibility. But he is a pretty hardcore advocate of determinism and of the idea that once you accept that, it frees you from moral responsibility. There's this incredible scene in, I think it's the first episode, maybe in the second. So after Nick Offerman, the Forrest character, has had the head of security at Amaya, his company, kill somebody at the end of the first episode, he and Pill sit down and they talk about, you know, it's sort of hard to get yourself to think about the fact that that's fine, that there's no moral judgment, there's no culpability, there's no responsibility. It's a little bit weird to think that way, but we know that it's true, right? And this is what he's trying to do, is convince himself and trying to create his philosophical version of Steve Jobs' reality distortion field. He is trying to live within a reality in which choices don't exist, in which the tram lines are set, in which no one can really be blamed for anything they do. And yes, I think he is struggling with it somewhat, but that's the world he appears to be determined to prove exists, or it is possible, like I said, we might see in the end that the twist is that he was actually trying to disprove it because he wants to understand his guilt.
Oh, I think I'm saying something separate, which is that the deterministic theory, actually affirms his guilt, that, you know, whatever caused him to make the phone call may be responsible for that, but he is the person, like, he is the cause.
No, but that's the whole point of that Alison Pill speech in the, I think, sixth episode, right? Where she says, like, everything has a thing that came before it. A complicated or a complex decision or action or event is not the same as a random event or even a choice.
But it's still, like, he is still the cause.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's an interesting
show,
the
cause,
and there's a lot to wrestle with.
But he was then caused, right? It all sort of goes back to the beginning of the beginning, right? And there's he is trying to make himself morally blameless. Because he wants to live in a world
where
morality doesn't exist.
But then
why
do you have the conversation with him and Pill where she sort of asks what he wants her to be doing there morally, and he, you know, is she a witness? Is she a juror? You know,
she's the one who offers up that she's a advocate for the defense, right? She says she's a lawyer for the defense.
Yeah.
Which is not what he says.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
And in fact, this is a thing that that tech companies, other companies as well, but tech companies in particular, just do as a matter of business practice, which is you have a theory of how your product is supposed to work, and sort of how the world is going to work, right? Like, this is how you're going to market it, right? All this stuff. And you pay somebody to basically say, here's all the ways that you could fail.
Yeah.
And ideally, you want somebody who actually kind of believes that.
Yeah.
In some ways, right? Like, who thinks that your business model is doomed, who thinks that your theory of your product is, like, just absolutely bonkers and isn't going to work. And, I mean, a term for this is red teaming. And so, you know, the show has taken that idea and turned it into a philosophical question, as well as a plot device. But I think the whole thing about Forrest is, at least on the surface, again, it's a little hard to know what he wants deep down because he's so haunted by the possibility that there were alternatives. But on the surface, he is trying to prove the case that there wasn't any way for his wife and child to survive, and that that was simply going to happen, and there was no other way for the world to go, because that will give him some measure of peace. Because if you know that there was no alternative and you know there was no choice, then you can't be haunted by the alternatives because they don't exist.
Yeah. And at the same time, we may be, like, splitting hairs here about incorrectly, perhaps, because, I mean, I think the show takes as a given that the multiverse is real. That's why we have these sequences where we see the same event happen six different ways and slightly different ways. But, you know, the question is...
And that's why the device works once
right.
you apply and a multiverse
exactly,
theory.
Exactly. Then once you are in a track, once you are in one of the worlds, there is only one way to go. So both are true at the same time. The multiverse is real. The tram lines are real. You are just on one tram line within the multiverse. You know, so anyway, I like the show a lot, and it's the sort of show that I feel like would spark a lot of these discussions if it wasn't trapped on Hulu on FX. So seek it out, people. Seek it out. I think we're all thumbs up here, but let me just, for the record, Alyssa, Peter, thumbs up, thumbs down.
Highest possible thumbs up.
Highest possible thumbs up.
Excellent. Also very
the
high.
Biggest
thumbs
possible
up.
Thumbs. My thumbs aren't high. My thumbs are gigantic.
My thumbs are as big as that giant creepy statue of Amaya in the middle of the campus. We didn't even talk about the giant creepy statue. Maybe next time. All right. Assigned viewing. Alyssa, why are we watching Netflix's Unbelievable this week?
We are watching Unbelievable, which is an adaptation of the 2015 Marshall Project and ProPublica feature, An Unbelievable Story of Rape, to set up for watching Netflix's adaptation of Robert Kolker's Lost Girls. Unbelievable stars Caitlin Dever as Marie, a young woman who's graduating from a sort of foster program for foster children, who is raped. We see her, you know, raped on the screen, reports it, and then comes under pressure to recant the story. And as we learn over the course of the miniseries, she has in fact been raped, and the fact that the police sort of discredit her story and in fact pursue her on a false report charge ends up hindering the efforts to track down her attacker, who is a serial rapist. And it's a really interesting true crime story. I watched this last year and loved it. Didn't get to write about it. But it inverts the genre in a lot of ways. Yes, it's a story about a serial criminal. It's a sex crime. It's really upsetting. But it's not sort of devoted to grotesquery and baroqueness. And like a sort of inverse True Detective, you have these two detectives played by Merritt Weaver and Toni Collette, who investigate the case not by sort of kicking down doors and breaking the rules, but through sort of persistence and empathy. And that ends up being the key to breaking the case, winning Marie's trust, and ultimately putting this guy away. And I find it very, it's a very interesting sort of fictionalized case for procedure, for communication, for doing things correctly, for a lot of values that are often sort of disregarded in both true crime stories and in drama about crime. And Lost Girls, which it's setting up for, is based on a book that has that same sort of empathy. The women Kolker writes about in Lost Girls were all, you know, impoverished sex workers who were killed by a serial killer. And the reason the book works is because he wins the trust of people who love these women, and is able to tell their stories in a really humane, comprehensive way. And I think that, look, there's a reason that people are shying away from true crime right now. People don't want to spend an enormous amount of time enmeshed in the ugliness of the human condition. But part of what Unbelievable reminds us is that true crime is a genre that's capable of being about what's best in people, too. And I just found it's very unshowy. Weaver and Collette and Deeper are all really great in it, but it's fairly low-key and non-flashy, which I think is one of the reasons it didn't get a lot of attention. But I think I found it really sort of morally uplifting to watch.
Peter?
It's really interesting as a procedural, just in the level of detail it goes into investigating this kind of assault, which you don't usually see in programming about sexual assault at all, right? And in the ways that these types of, sort of the particular format of these investigations, right? And we are at this point in the true crime and crime serial era, we are just super acquainted with all of the aspects of investigating a murder, and the ways that cops might go about doing that. And there are shows that are much more realistic and much less so. But we've pretty much explored that territory in great detail, and I felt like I was seeing scenes that, in some ways, were familiar enough in that they involved talking to witnesses, they involved collection of evidence, right? All of the kind of basic trappings of detective stories that everybody is familiar with if you've ever read anything, you know, in the genre at all. And yet, I'd never seen them quite this way before. I'd never seen these types of scenes. I've never seen them presented, in particular in the first episode, primarily from the perspective of the victim. And it is not about the first episode in particular is not about the cops. It's not about the detectives. It's about how how the procedure and how the process affects the victim and how it feels to her in a way that is fairly unique. And what's really interesting then is the second episode very nearly repeats the sequence, except it does so in a way that shows in the first episode, the victim is re-traumatized by the process. And that creates a series of problems for the investigation. In the second episode, the process goes in some ways exactly the same, right? It is here, tell me what happened. Here, you need to give a statement. Here, we're going to have to do some stuff that is medically invasive to your body because we need to collect evidence from your body. Here, I need you to actually go back to the room where it happened. I'm sorry, this is unfortunate. But in the second episode, you have a different detective, a different time frame. The detective is played by Barrett Weaver, who is just incredible, who has an affect that I think I've never seen, maybe on camera at all, but in a detective show for a detective, right? Someone who you both find very competent, but also just doesn't seem aggressive in the normal way. Instead seems totally firm, right?
Well,
just presents a very different ideal of competence and of firmness and, you know, strength in a detective. In any case, it's very interesting as a procedural.
You said something really interesting there about how focused the show is on the victim. And I think that is the point that it's trying to make to a certain extent, because, you know, the title of the series is Unbelievable. That word again is in the story that the article is based on. And both the article and the show are about the idea that we have a clear concept of what a believable story of rape sounds like. And the show and the article are both dedicated to sort of dismantling that. But, you know, they do something really radical for, I think, police shows by kind of inverting everything, right? I mean, you guys haven't seen the end of it, so we will get to the perpetrator eventually, but he's just not the most important part of the story. And but again, that inversion does something really interesting. It says, you know, if you don't listen to the witness and hear what she has to say, you won't get the essential information out of her. If you lose her cooperation, you may lose information that is valuable down the line in other cases. And it affirms, you know, in this case, the best detectives for the case are people whose primary dedication, like the value that they embody, is not, you know, I'm going to kick down doors and intimidate people in a holding cell. It's kindness and the ability to listen. And that's the kind of, I mean, in general, pop culture that sort of affirms feminine values is not, you know, generally treated as particularly radical. But I would argue that this actually really is, even if it wasn't recognized as such at the time.
I will just say, I actually did find the first episode in particular quite hard to watch. And it was, I almost didn't get to the second episode just because I found the first episode so difficult just to watch. It is, I mean, violence against women is difficult in any circumstance. Even something, you know, even when it is obviously fictionalized and sort of, you know, not in a perfect, you know, as a realistic setting like this, you know, I find actually like the beginning of Unforgiven to be a little bit difficult to watch. But in this episode, you get both glimpses of the attack itself and then just this kind of extended process in which she has to sort of go through it and think about it and talk to people. And it's very difficult to watch. And it wasn't until the second episode where you get, again, this sort of the same sequence, but in a way that is designed to show how it can work better. And also where you start to see how detectives might actually solve this rather than botch it, where you have a victim who's providing clear information, where, you know, sort of the story changes, that I found myself sort of a little more engrossed. And so it was, I thought the first episode was quite difficult to watch, but understandably so, like, right? It's supposed to be.
There's not supposed to be something that sort of distracts right? you from it or lets you go away. It just, the plainness of it really forces you to be present.
Can I ask? So I was not unfortunately able to watch the show this week. Could I get a quick compare and contrast with the other big Netflix procedural of this vein, Mindhunter? Just in terms of the, because it sounds to me like they're actually kind of similar shows. Not identical, obviously, but.
Yeah, I mean, look, Mindhunter is just a lot more focused on the cops. And, you know, this is just much more focused on sort of the victim's experience. I mean, I think that Holden in Mindhunter, which I also love Mindhunter, is just, he's like colder and more academic, right? He is a good listener. He is curious, but yeah, it's and I think Mindhunter has an argument to make about sort of a theory of crime, but not necessarily a theory of police work, if that makes any sense.
I don't know if I quite agree with that.
Not the best way to put it. But
Mindhunter is certainly much less focused on the victims. And on their experience and on the trauma of the experience. The other thing about Mindhunter is it's a David Fincher production through and through. Even with the episodes that he's not directing, his style is very clearly, you know, embedded in the show. And it is a show about, it is just a much more stylish show, much more concerned with mood and tone, and with you know, sort of creating that sort of Fincherian, very slick, but also very grim sense of place and sense of mood. And it's not that there's no style to Unbelievable, right? Like it's purposefully quite raw and quite gritty. But it's not as showy in its style, in its stylishness. And it doesn't put the stylishness first, right? I mean, like you watch a David Fincher production in part just to see what he does with the camera and to see how he moves it, to see how everything is lit. And it's that alone is sort of a value even beyond however interesting it is about serial killers or however good the acting is. And in Unbelievable, I think that's at least somewhat less the case, which is not to say, again, that they didn't think about what they were doing stylistically, just that they're not.
They don't want to take it in the way. Yeah, I mean, what I should actually say is that Mindhunter is much more interested in criminals than in victims. It's interested in victims insofar as, you know, I mean, part of what was really interesting about the last season was sort of this conflict between, Holden and company, who have one sense of who is committing the Atlanta child murders and the really profound need from the surviving parents to believe that the Klan is somehow involved. Unbelievable is just not that interested in what makes someone a serial rapist, right? It's interested in the criminal in so much as it's interested in understanding his methodology so it can catch him, but it just really strenuously focuses on the idea that he's a much less important person than his victims.
Mm-hmm. All right, that is it for today's show. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. And remember, for the next 2 months, it's free. Just look for the box at the top of the site for the link to the deal. If you love the show, tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. And if we don't grow, we will die. We are very much like sharks. And review us at Apple and everywhere else. Reviews of podcasts are accepted. If you didn't love today's episode, complain to me on Twitter at SonnyBunch. I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sonny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sonny Bunch and Natasha Passetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonier. Associate producer, Jessica Safa-Vamer. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sonny Bunch, with music by James Malone.